players here. Let us start. Okay.
Okay.
There you go.
What? Keeping out of trouble.
Good morning. No. I'm called meeting the Actuarial Services Subcommittee of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement for October 9th, 2008. We do have a quorum here. This subcommittee was established by the Full Pensions Commission for the purpose of looking at the issue that passed in the 2008 legislation under which the Pensions Commission is going to have the opportunity to have our own actuarial review of the major funds. And so, Mr. Martin, you did prepare a memo. Did you want to kind of give us some of the highlights and some of the things that we need to consider here for our recommendations to the full commission?
Sure, members. I have an October 1st document. The first several pages gives you some notions or what your options might be or alternatives are in proceeding. And then there are several attachments, including some potential or some model or at least examples of requests for our proposals from other pension operations. Also a list of potential actuaries who could be utilized or contacted with an RFP. We're here under Laws 2008, Chapter 349, Article 10, primarily Section 9, which empowers the Commission to retain a consulting actuarial firm to review or to audit the work of the consulting actuarial firms that are retained by the various retirement systems. As the bottom of page 1 and the top of page 2 indicate, there's considerable latitude in this authorization to the Pension Commission. Retaining an auditing actuary is permitted, not mandated. It does have to be an outside third-party consultant. It must be a fellow in the Society of Actuaries, a private enterprise designation credentialing organization. Directive is to audit or review, but there is not any particular specificity about the nature or the scope, so you have considerable latitude. You also have considerable latitude in putting together a schedule for how you want the review or audit to be undertaken. There is a requirement that the various actuaries retained by the various retirement systems must cooperate and provide data to the reviewing actuary retained by the Pension Commission. And there's no particular contracting process specified in statute and no specified duration limit for the contract. So you have considerable latitude. On page 2 and the top of page 3, I try and identify the various services that an actuary does provide, and this I think would allow you to come to some conclusion about which of these services you want the auditing or reviewing actuary to be involved and which services that normally are conducted by a consulting actuary you do not want to have are reviewed or reviewed only on an as-needed basis. The primary one on the bottom of page 2, number 1, is the actuarial evaluation process. Because we have defined benefit plans in the state of Minnesota primarily, actuarial evaluations is the way that we keep track of whether we're funding the various pension plan liabilities that are being amassed in an adequate fashion. Item 2 is the experience studies. We have for some time now done experience studies for the three largest of our pension plans, the general plan of MSRS, the general plan of PERA, and TRA. We do other experience studies on a more irregular schedule. And the purpose of the experience studies is to validate the actuarial assumptions that are being used, monitor them, and determine their usefulness for continuing use in the actuarial evaluation process. Item three has to do with doing cost estimates for our potential benefit increases, typically during the odd legislative session. And then the remainder are more ongoing functions. Whenever there are actuarial assumption changes, particularly mortality or interest assumption changes, the forms and reserve factors used by the various pension funds should change. When you're going to calculate a joint and survivor option and you've changed the mortality assumption, someone has to work out the new tables that are being used. Then there are prior service credit purchase determinations. There are also privatization determinations, the gain and loss determinations. We have a statute chapter which utilizes some of the gain that's incurred by having individuals leave public service prematurely, or leave public pension plan membership prematurely when their employer privatizes, and we utilize some or all of that gain in a somewhat enhanced benefit for those privatized employees to make them closer to whole. And then the seventh item is general benefit plan design and consulting. So I think the first task that you have is to try and figure out where you want to place the emphasis by a reviewing and auditing actuary. If you just want the actuary to look at the actuarial valuations and experience studies, or do you want the actuary to go beyond that to some of the other tasks? I do observe that from a legislative standpoint, we probably have the greatest interest in the benefit cost estimates when you're considering a piece of legislation that increases the benefits. You want to make sure that the actuarial work that's provided to you is accurate. It's also done on usually short time frames and is problematic in lots of ways to a review in some sort of systematic way. But that's the area where the process can be misled if there's inaccurate or incomplete or erroneous information or processing. So it's fraught with the greatest danger from a legislative standpoint, and because of the timing considerations, it's probably open to the least scrutiny. So I do make that observation. Mr. Chair, I don't know if you want to go through this in parts or if you want me to talk about the balance of the memo and come back.
Let me give just some initial impressions. I read through the memo. I didn't get the attachments previously, but that's fine. I got a pretty good idea of what. I think most people here are aware that the Pensions Commission used to have its own actuary, and I think you mentioned that in your memo too. And we eliminated that pension actuary for a number of reasons. First of all, the individual we're dealing with was retiring. There were budget cuts, and so it was easier to have the pension funds pay for their own actuary and report to us. And there's some questions about the liability that we're having issues as to whether or not, because that firm wanted us to sign something that said that we wouldn't hold them responsible if they came back with erroneous assumptions. And we thought, well, that's why we're hiring you in the first place. So for a number of reasons, you know, we went in a different direction. But I think over the past few years, we were missing something from our standpoint, from the commission standpoint, that we need a fresh set of eyes actually looking at the reports of the funds. It seems to me, though, that you know the amount that we're dealing with, $140,000, is going to limit us as to just how much we can expect, you know, to get. I don't think we're going to have any full-blown reviews. I mean, we still have to rely upon the pension funds actuaries to do the full reviews of that. I guess it's possible down the road, if that's what we just direct our consultant to do, but initially I don't think that's going to be possible, nor do I think it's realistic that they're to expect that they're going to review every single bill or every single issue that comes before us. But I do agree with you that, you know, issues like cost, benefit cost analysis, I think that's important because what we do in one area tends to have bigger consequences down the road. What I don't know is whoever we go with, if we go in this direction, how deep are they going to want to go? If a consulting actuary says, well, I'll do it, but I'm going to have to do a full-blown review in order to be able to give you advice, does that create any additional problems, or do we even have the funds to do that? I don't know, but I do think that we need to get a better handle on the information that's coming to us. But that's just how I see it. Representative Smith, Representative Nelson, do you have any thoughts on which direction we ought to go and recommend to the full commission before we go deeper here?
Mr. Chairman, I think you've summarized where we've been. And so we've had a look in the rear view. Now we've got to look through the windshield. I think our control, meaning the commission and the legislature, is over the new hiree, simply would, after we determine qualifications during that process, is simply state the salary that's going to be paid and what we do and don't expect. And that's just simply part of the contract. And that would be our control over. Right.
I'm sure the bidders are going to come back and say, well, $140,000, here's what we'll do and here's what we won't do, and I think we'll get a better handle on it. I don't know that we're in a position at this moment to tell the Pension Commission where we should go. I think that's going to have to go through the RFP process and figure out what comes back at us. So, well, do you have anything further that you want to go over, Mr. Martin?
Members, if there are some qualification questions that you might want to look at, and I started that on the bottom of page 3. The practical problem is trying to determine, of the couple hundred possible actuaries who could be mailed an RFP, are there some requirements that you want of your consulting actuary that would rule out some of those, so we can cut the list down to a somewhat smaller list? And so I start on the bottom of page 3, location. The list that I have is actually on page 7 of your document. It follows the memo, and it goes for a few pages. I took the most recent meeting of the Enrolled Actuaries Organization throughout the corporate, those actuaries who are employed already by government or employed by non-actuarial companies, or our academics, and got rid of the duplications where there are multiple actuaries from one firm. Then I cross-checked the remaining list against the database with the Society of Actuaries to determine that whether or not there was a fellow in the Society of Actuaries, which is required, the requirement for being an approved actuary in Minnesota. And I came up with list that you have, which is, if I remember correctly, 200 and slightly over 200 different actuarial firms. And I've broken them down by location, where a national firm is involved and there is an office in Minnesota. I have that national firm listed under Minnesota rather than their actual home office. So there is a slight a discrepancy. Otherwise, it would be home office. So this gives you an idea of the potential actuaries that are out there and where they're located. If location matters in your notion of how you want to design this task, then we can divide the list down or narrow the list down on that basis. The next item is firm size. One of the things in looking at the list that starts on page 7 is that some of these are obviously multiple actuaries working in a firm. Other instances, they're obviously a single practitioner. And if the size matters to you, that would also be a way to narrow down the possible list. The third item is prior experience as a reviewing actuary. That's something I don't have a good handle on. It's not something that pops up in any readily identifiable database. So, but that would be a factor that you may want to require of a potential bidder, that they have some prior experience being a reviewing actuary. The fourth item on page four is prior experience with Minnesota public pension plans. The learning curve presumably is not as steep if an actuarial firm has some experience with our plans previously. Five has to do with the time availability. The work of a reviewing actuary is not as time sensitive as the work of the regular production actuaries who do need to. Well, you've taken the deadline for the actuarial work out this last session. It used to be November 1st. Now it's open, but presumably for accounting, annual financial reporting purposes, and other reasons, there is still a functional deadline of sometime during the fall for the production actuaries. The reviewing actuary can presumably conduct their work later than just during the fall. But if time availability, if you want to actually see the individual that you're hiring periodically at commission meetings or providing information to you on a one-on-one basis during the course of a legislative session or something, time availability may be a factor. And they may have difficulties because of other clients or other commitments in meeting your time availability during the spring or whatever you think the concentration of your work product might be. Six has to do with data processing. These are relatively large public pension funds. A solo practitioner may or may not have the data processing capabilities to actually run a full valuation, a parallel or duplicate valuation. So you may want to look at that. Seven has to do with contractual our relationships with Minnesota public pension plans, either recently or currently. And this is a conflict of interest sort of concern. We have been contacted by one firm that does do some work for Minnesota public pension plans about this reviewing or auditing actuarial post. Although there is precedent for having a production actuary also be the reviewing actuary, the Pension Commission from 1955 until 1984 retained a local actuarial firm with Stennis and Associates in Bloomington. They were eventually bought out by Towers, Perrin, Forster, and Crosby in the early 70s. And Dr. Franklin Smith, for most of that time, was the commission actuary. He also was the actuary for the State Patrol Pension Plan. He was an academic at St. Thomas and an ASA, not an FSA, with the Stennis firm. So we have utilized a production actuary as the reviewing actuary for all other valuations. So there's some precedent that did work. It may have worked because of the individual involved or the exigencies of the circumstances. I'm not sure. I came late to that process and wasn't party to what the thoughts were when it was first set up. But if there is a concern about whether a reviewing actuary can adequately monitor either other actuaries' work or their own work, then that's raised by point seven. And then point eight are the issues that gave trouble to the last actuarial services subcommittee, the liability limitation and third-party our reliance issues, whether that is a consideration that you want to delve into. So that
okay. Well, thank
it's
you.
It's a somewhat practical issue of how we do the RFP, who we send the RFP, whatever the RFP may look like, and if you wanted to shorten down the list by sure. making certain choices at this point.
Just question on my part. I know the world's changed as far as sending out notices and so forth. I don't know if anybody actually mails those things out anymore. But I'm sure they do. Is it possible, for instance, if we come up with a criteria that we could contact, like the Society of Actuaries, and say, you know, here's something, and if you want, they want to post it on their internet and send it out to their members, they would know, as opposed to us having to physically mail something out to everybody. We might, there might be somebody out there that might be very well qualified. We just don't know about them, and you know, they might have more access than we do.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking of trying to consult or trying to transmit the RFP, if it is a large potential group of mm-hmm. our recipients, electronically in some fashion, also posting it on the state register, which we've done in the past. And I've not explored whether the Society of Actuaries does that transmission service, but that obviously would make sense to utilize them if possible. I was hoping not to have to mail a large document by U.S. Post to a large number of potential consulting actuaries if I didn't have to.
Well, let's put it the other way. If somebody out there doesn't have electronic access, I'm not sure that we're interested in having them bid, you know. So, Representative Smith or Nelson, did you have any?
Mr. Chairman, of staff, remind me, when was a last actuarial subcommittee?
Senator Bessel was the chair, I recall. That would have been 4 years ago or 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah. As we've utilized having the pension funds jointly for the past 3 years, and I think we had Milliman for a 2-year contract the last time that we utilized them.
Mr.
So
Chairman,
it would have been some 5 years ago.
Two-part question. As a subcommittee to the commission, is part of our task to come up with a proposed RFP, and secondly, to also come up with proposed qualifications that the pension commission requires?
I think, Representative Smith, what we can do is we'll make recommendations, obviously, to the commission. If they want to go in a different direction, they can do so. I think if we weigh the factors that Mr. Martin has just outlined on 3 and 4, what we think are issues of importance, I think that could help determine what the RFP is ultimately going to look like. And as I say, if the commission wants to take a different view, they certainly can. But I think that's our responsibility to say, for instance, location, does that matter or not? Firm size, does it matter or not? For instance, on firm size, I would be surprised if we went with, you know, a sole practitioner somewhere. I mean, we probably want somebody with the background and resources, but, you know, that's just what I think. But we'll make our recommendations and see what the commission wants to do with them. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman, I think it does. Did we generate an RFP 4 years ago?
I think we did, yes.
Is it in our packet?
No.
Why should we reinvent the wheel? Why don't we look at that and go from there and determine if we want to even change it, or, and if so, how?
That was 4 years ago. We had Milliman bid for it, and then this guy from California. I think those were the only two that did not. And plus,
EFI, which is actually in Washington, D.C.,
okay,
with a California
right.
branch office also.
Plus, I think what we're proposing here is going to be a different role, because we're actually looking for the commission actuary in the past. And this is going to be a different job as a consultant here. So I think there may be different people that, you know, would have, for whatever reason, did not bid last time, that might have an interest now based upon, you know, the differences in what we're doing here. So, but it's a good point. You know, I think that if it could be done electronically, I just think putting the word out and just seeing who's out there and what the interest is, we might find out something we may not have known 5 years ago.
Well,
Representative Smith.
The RFP that we generated, staff probably generated 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Now that we want to apply it a little differently to the commission as a whole, if that's the case, would the RFP have to look any different? It would be requiring the same things only for the commission this time. And secondly, if that could just be, you know, word processing change in some of the terms, that's one thing. Unless, you know, the world has significantly changed from then till now, then we would just simply have to add new qualifications.
Sure.
the role and function, if I may, is somewhat different of an auditing actuary as compared to a production actuary. We were hiring the baseline actuary who's doing the valuations for all of the various pension funds. So the RFP spent a lot of time telling them something about the various pension funds, how many members there are, what sort of benefit plan was in place, so they could figure out whether they could program their computers to do the actuarial evaluation work. With the reviewing actuary, you're either having an actuary look at the work product of another actuary and gauge its reasonableness, its accuracy, or potentially replicate some or all of the valuations on some sort of a schedule. So it's more of a monitoring junkyard dog review rather than the ongoing production which we were previously contracting for. And while it doesn't maybe sound like a huge difference, it is a definite difference in emphasis, looking at reasonableness, going through the actuarial work produced by someone else, raising questions, resolving disputes, identifying errors, rather than just coming up with what's the normal cost, what's the accrued liability of the pension fund overall. So while we can adapt the existing RFP, it gives us, well, because there's a shift in the emphasis, it's a little different beast and a little harder to just make a couple of nuanced changes. We certainly would start with our RFP and try and boil it down. One of the reasons why I laid out the possible services that you could have the reviewing actuary be involved in is the more services that the actuary would be reviewing. If our reviewing actuary was going to look at the option factors from the various pension funds as part of our review, that's different than if they're just looking at the reasonableness of the actuarial assumptions used in performing the regular actuarial valuations of the pension fund, which mostly means that they look with new eyes at the most recent experience study and try and figure out whether the mortality table used by the pension fund is the right mortality table, rather than necessarily doing an awful lot of calculations. So a lot of what we were doing before was just the raw generation of calculations and the preparation of reports based on those calculations. Depending on what you want the actuary to do, there could be a lot of mental work and not a whole lot of calculations, or if you're trying to replicate the prior evaluations, a whole lot of data processing also.
Mr. Chair, when does Chair Murphy want our advice, and will we be meeting again before session?
Did we have a deadline? Give it to us. I don't recall.
Mr. Chair, I don't recall seeing any written correspondence to you that laid out your mission or any time constraints or any expectations. I don't know what the nature of the conversation you may have had with Representative Murphy was, so I'm not aware that there is any particular expectation about timing.
She did not tell me that. If there's the desire of the subcommittee to meet again, we'll do so. It'll be after the elections. Okay, so that I recognize you guys are in a crunch right now. So, and I want to get we have done today, but if you want to meet one more time, we will do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at getting the best product.
Sure.
In other words, our advice to Chair Murphy and the commission mm-hmm. that we can. I'm wondering if I don't know how you want to do this meeting today, but here's a suggestion.
Sure.
Why can't we instruct Mr. Martin to review what our work product from last time mm-hmm. and revise an RFP to apply to a junkyard dog? Yeah. And then today we could go through what emphasis we think should be placed on location, firm size, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then by the time we have the revised RFP, then we can get our advice to Chairman.
I was thinking along the same lines. If we go through these factors here and identify what we think is important and then have another meeting and we can find out how close this one is to what we've done in the past, and then we can either reconcile it or, if nothing else, at least go to the full commission and say, here's what we did in the past, here's what we're recommending, and then we'd have to have some reasons why we think it's more important now. So I agree with that.
Good.
Anything else? Well, why don't we just kind of go through these factors here? Some, I think, will go fairly quickly. Number one was location. In an ideal world, I think somebody would be here in Minnesota or at least in the upper Midwest. I don't know that that's so required. I mean, if somebody can do a good job reviewing it in some other state, I suppose, you know, having the body physically here more than a couple of times a year, you know, it's desirable. But, you know, my thoughts were to just say, prefer somebody in Minnesota, the upper Midwest, but not required. You know, what's your thoughts?
With the electronic transmission of data and everything back and forth, I don't see if that's as big of an issue as it probably used to be.
Yeah.
So I kind of agree with what you're saying. It's preferable to have somebody here, you know, down the street, but, you know, they can be here when we need them. That's the important part.
Okay. Representative Smith, any thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I think ultimately I agree with what both of you have said, with one caveat. There's nothing more compelling and important for, excuse me, than face-to-face contact within a commission meeting when that time comes. If I may ask of Mr. Martin, can you recall in the past, on average, how many times we as a pension commission have required an actuary or our actuary to come before us? Once a year, twice a year, about how many times?
Mr. Smith, in the last several years of the Milliman contract, it was probably once a year, no more than twice a year. In the early period when Wyatt had the contract, it was somewhat more frequently, maybe two or three times per year, but probably never more than a couple, three times per year.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think then that our advice to Chair Murphy would be that location does not matter, but that's so long as the potential applicants understand that we have X thousands of dollars as a budget. Mm-hmm. And secondly, while we may only require one or two, as we have in the past, appearances before the commission, that it would be at our pleasure. It could be more than that. Then
sure.
They can make the decision if they can make a dollar under those conditions.
And that might be, if we get down to some equally qualified candidates, maybe that's going to be the thing that tips it one way or the other, you know, where their location is. So it's not at the top of the list.
Right.
It's helpful to have them, you know, here or readily available. Mr. Custis used to be in Milwaukee, and that's not that far away. I mean, it's a plane trip away, so okay. Do you anything worth further on that? You've got that one done. Okay. Firm size. As I say, I think my own, I don't know the size of these things, but I think a sole practitioner is probably going to have might be a very good person to do it, but I think I would like to, you know, not put all my eggs in one basket. So if the person gets sick or dies or gets a different job or becomes disabled, you know, then we got to go through this process again. I'd like to think there's some backup here, but how big of a size, I don't really have a feel for that.
Mr. Chair, I don't recall that we put a firm size condition in our past RFPs. I think that we should be careful in again, not doing that because it doesn't matter. But I think we should be mindful of the fact, as you said, that we want someone here at our beck and call, not when they're able to make it.
Okay. And perhaps we could ask, as part of the RFP, the bidders to identify, you know, their size, or if it's a small firm, you know, just how they intend to address doing the job in case of the change within the firm or the individual or whatever, so that they have the adequate resources to carry it out. If it's a small firm and can do the job, that may be fine. But I think they need to explain to us how they're going to do it,
exactly.
Not to us to identify that. So do you have enough? Anything further?
That sounds good.
Okay. Prior experience as a reviewing and auditing actuary. I think that having somebody who has actually done something before is kind of important. How much prior experience? I don't know that we need to set that in stone or say that, you know, here's what we're looking for. But I think they need to state that they've got some prior experience here.
Provide a resume.
Yeah, provide
something with they've done it.
Prior experience is required, but I don't think I want to say 1 year, 5 years, or 10 years, or 20 years, or whatever. Just they have to have some prior experience. This can't be the first thing they've ever done.
So it's show us at least that they're capable of performing the work, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anything further? Okay. Four, prior experience with Minnesota public pension plans. I think that would be helpful, not necessarily required. I think we could say that, if they're not familiar with Minnesota pension plans at all, I think they're going to have to explain to us how they intend to get up to speed, what they intend to do to learn about them. But we could theoretically run into the conflict of interest that you've talked about, where the only people who know about Minnesota pension plans are the ones who've done them, and now they're being asked to review their own work. So, Representative Smith, what I suggested on prior experience with Minnesota plans, you stepped out the previous one. I just suggested prior experience is going to be required, but I don't think we need to specify. They have to tell us what their prior experience is. We don't want somebody that's the first time they've ever done this is this one here, but they have to have some prior experience. So, do you have any thoughts as to how much?
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you. We don't need to specify, but I think we know that when somebody's done something a few times before, they can do it again.
Right.
So I think that should be in our minds when we talk to them.
And they can tell us what they've done before, and we'll be the judge of whether we're satisfied with that. Now, as for prior experience with Minnesota public pension plans, I think that's helpful. I don't think it's necessarily a prerequisite. If they're not familiar with Minnesota pension plans, they have to state how they're going to become familiar with it. And, of course, the other side of it, the people who are familiar with it probably are already doing it, which might create the conflict of interest of a consultant. So I think it's helpful to have that, but we'll just have to find out, I think, from the potential bidders what they think of, what they're going to do in order to find that. So any other thoughts on that issue? Okay.
Agreed.
Time availability. As I recall, Mr. Martin, you didn't think that this was going to be that big of an issue because most of their work is going to be done, metered out and so forth. So we want them available at periodic times, but this is not going to be we got a bill introduced today. Can you look at it and be here tomorrow and like that? So
yes, members, that was of great concern when we had when we were hiring the actuary who was doing the basic valuations and was doing the official costing out of benefit proposals. Having a time turnaround was very important when it's the only actuarial work you're going to have on a piece of legislation. And we are responsible for having that done. If the reviewing actuary is not going to be involved in looking at benefit costings, then it's not a consideration probably of any great consequence. If that person is expected, however, to replicate or to try and approximate in some fashion what the benefit costing is to determine how reasonable the other actuary's work is, then time considerations are more important because you have a time constraint on the legislative session and there are other schedules and odd deadlines that are bearing and frequently cost estimates, well, they're difficult at best because the process of the legislative process with amending bills makes it difficult sometimes to have a consistent estimate if mm-hmm. the bill is still in flux. And it may not firm up until right towards the end. Indeed, if you remember last session, you were still considering a possible teacher pension benefit increase right up to the day that the conference committee met. So getting some information, if the reviewing actuary is to be involved in that benefit costing process in some fashion, may be of some concern. If they're not, then it's probably of no particular real urgent time availability is probably not a big important item.
I think that as far as availability, we want them to meet with us periodically. I don't think there's going to be a set time. We don't anticipate short-term deadlines, but we do expect, every year that they're going to be taking long-range views of the pension plans and the policies that are adopting and report back to us. And they're going to have to do that on a somewhat regular basis, I think. Not wait 2 or 3 years till we hear from them. So I think that, but I think we need to stress that this is going to be, you know, more of an annual, I think, job than it is, you know, got to get it done right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are we okay on that one? Okay, data processing capabilities. Well, obviously, I think they're going to have to. That's just something they're going to have to tell us what it is. They have to be able to analyze and review some very large pension plans and a couple of small ones, and be able to do that. And if they're not capable of doing that, that's going to be disqualifier at the get-go. Okay, contractual relationships with Minnesota pension plans. Yes, if they have, as you've indicated, somebody has already contacted the commission about that. If they already have a relationship with them, I think they're going to have to state what it is and how they intend to resolve it. I'd rather not get into the, I hope we don't get in the situation where we have somebody, well, they've got a conflict of interest, so they're going to have to find somebody else to do it. I mean, I'd like to deal with one entity. If there is an occasional conflict that comes up, I guess we're going to have to figure out how we can work around it. But it's up to them to state to us if they've got any possible conflicts, and we can evaluate where we're going to go from there. The liability limits and third-party reliance, that may be an issue that, again, we have to negotiate with it, but I think we're going to have to state up front that we do expect to rely upon their work product, and that we're not probably going to be interested in having somebody having us sign off on something to say, well, don't hold them accountable for what they tell us, because we are going to be holding them accountable.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Two points. On the liability limits, I think, yeah. I agree with you. I believe our RFP should have the toughest requirement of liability that we can think of, because it may be part of our negotiation with prospective applicants anyway, and we probably shouldn't get too deep into what I'm saying here. But we can negotiate down from a tough stand if we choose,
sure.
If the Pension Commission chooses. Getting back to the conflict of interest of seven, just a simple question. A conflict, this applicant will, we want to avoid a conflict of interest of them with who? With pension plans in Minnesota, with legislators, combination of the above? Who are we wanting them to not have a conflict of interest with?
As I see it, it's we're utilizing the reviewing actuary to gain a third-party opinion about the quality of the actuarial work performed by the other actuaries retained by Minnesota Public Pension Plans. And if there's a relationship that throws that into some doubt, that they can't express a third-party opinion independent of another pension actuary, then there's a problem.
Like Siegel Company currently does some actuary work for some of our plans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we want to hire them to be the consulting firm to us when they're already doing the work. They'd be basically reviewing their own work, which doesn't make any sense, and that's why there'd be a conflict there. So, and some of these firms may have done some minor consulting work or some major ones along the way, but that's the conflict that I see. Having the consultant reviewing its own work that was done for somebody else.
Mr. Chair, I think we're talking like Oxley-Slaughters, was that? But the accounting firms for the federal are the big government, big companies do, or that Oxley-Sorbane or whatever that law is in the federal government, where they're having people review it. I think that's what we're looking at. We don't want Siegel reviewing Siegel's work and saying okie doke, looks good to me, and the same guy doing it. I think we want somebody else looking at, and so that would, in my mind, would rule somebody out, that if they are doing some of it for one of the other pension plans, we don't want them to be the ones overlooking everything.
Now, it's possible, say, with a large firm, you know, maybe they can build an appropriate firewall and explain mm-hmm. to us how some will do, you know, the work, but then somebody else will be the consulting work, and There's not going to be any slippage, but they have to explain to us how they're going to get around, you know, any of those conflicts. But that was the conflict that I was thinking of Representative Smith. I wasn't really thinking about anything further because I'm not thinking of any right now. So
then, Mr. Chairman, the only conflict of interest scenario we would be looking at is, this is a question, if the applicant has had a working relationship with a existing Minnesota plan in the past but no longer does, that's not a conflict of interest. But that if they're hired on now by a current plan and still have it, that is a conflict of interest.
If they have had either a past or a current contractual relationship with a Minnesota public pension plan, I think we would like to know that. Mm. And if we think it's significant, then we can ask them, you know, further details about it and how they intend to resolve any mm-hmm. potential conflicts of interest. So, you know, it's hard in the abstract to identify every scenario, but it's up to them to identify past or present relationships they've had, and then questions may arise from that.
Good. Thank you.
Anything else on these? Mr. Martin, do you have anything further? Do you have enough on these factors to look at?
I think so, yes.
Is there anything further you need from us to start the RFP process going?
Mr. Chair, early discussion, they talked about time. I think I read in here time, length of the contract.
Sure.
Do we want to review this every 2 years, every 4 years?
Yeah.
Do we want to hire somebody and with an open-ended contract? I think we need to discuss that because that could determine whether somebody takes it or not.
And here's where it might differ from our previous commission actuary, because before no one was going to touch it unless they had a long-term agreement, mm-hmm. because they're going to spend a lot of time reviewing some major pension plan issues, and there was a lot of work up front that had to be done. I don't know whether this falls in the same category, but you've got to make it long enough to make it worthwhile for people to bid on it. But I don't know. Mr. Martin, do you have any thoughts on that?
Members, again, I think it depends on what you want the actuary to do. If they're to replicate the actuarial work, some of the actuarial work, they have the upfront capital costs of having to program mm-hmm. their data processing equipment to fully encompass our benefit plans and be able to turn out evaluations. So the longer you have a contract for, if they do have to, and potentially if you're going to have them ultimately review all of the plans and replicate valuations for all of the plans, they're going to have to at some point translate all of these benefit plans into their systems, which is a certain commitment of time, and that's where a longer contract allows them to amortize that cost
mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Over a longer period.
Or was it Smith, yeah.
Again, under the column of not reinventing the wheel, do you know or can you find out of the other 49 states how many have legislative pension commissions, and of those how many have their own actuary hired under the process we're now doing, and therefore see what their terms are? We may, rather than pick a number out of the hat, which could be 2 years because that's how long we're in a session, the other side of the coin is, since this is a commission hiree, the commission doesn't need legislative approval. We can do it every 3 years or five or whatever we choose. But it would be nice to know other jurisdictions in our similar situation what their term of hiring is.
Mr. Members, I can give you half of the information, not all of it, unfortunately. Slightly less than half of the states have a commission somewhat comparable to the Minnesota Pension Commission. And what goes on in the other roughly half of the states is somewhat hard to know. Now, not every commission replicates this commission. We're wholly legislative, and some of the commissions are other commissions, like the Pennsylvania Pension Commission that I worked for 4 years, was both a mix of executive branch and legislative members. We did survey a couple of years ago what they're doing with actuarial work, but I've not had that redone in the past several years. So it's something we can do for the next meeting to find out what actuarial work is how they structure their actuarial work currently. It was something I did explore a few years back, but have not updated it. So, and I don't recall offhand what the norm would be, but I can give you some sense of what we found out a few years ago, and we'll try and update that in the interval.
And the full commission may want the information too. So if we got the time to kind of pull it together, that may be helpful. When I was trying to imagine and envision what the consulting actuary is going to do, and it sort of seemed to me that the first year they're going to have to sort of get a feel for what the funds do, and then at some point, maybe each year they'd look at one of the major funds and a couple of minor funds and just kind of review their work. I'm thinking at least a three-year term initially is going to be needed to kind of get that thing rolling to see if it's working out or not. I less than that, I don't know if we're going to get anybody to do it. Longer than that, I think we're going to try to, we'd be boxing ourselves in, but 3 years with, you know, possible extensions if we feel that the consultant is doing good work. My initial thoughts would be something along those lines, but do you have any other approaches that we want to take?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I was kind of thinking along the same line, but I was thinking maybe 5 years, but a 3 to 5 year initial and then review an extension of 1 year or 2 years. And similar thoughts about then, you know, at the beginning they're going to have to come in, they're going to have to build in whatever their costs are for, like it was talked about with the computer, getting their systems up to speed so they can review these things. And then they're going to have to, you know, charge that out over the contract. If it's too short, it may be cost prohibitive in, you know, for them to do it, and we may not get any bidders. So I 3 to 5 years, it sounds like a reasonable thing to look at to start out with and then review it and with possible extensions, unless there is something in law that prohibits that or that there are extensions. That's another thing I was looking at. Is there something in law that limits what we can do?
I'm not aware of any, but, you know, it also seems to be just knowing how this place works around here. Talking 1 year extensions never works. I mean, we spend more time doing the work. If you're going to extend it, it's going to be for at least 2 years, I think. But Mr. Martin?
Members, you may have a better feel for this than I do. Doing it on an odd numbered basis for the first time out will throw the contracting process into a year where you're not facing a general election as you are now,
right.
And is a better year physically for you folks to do this sort of deliberation. It was a problem in several of our past contractual efforts that it would always occur either right at the end of a legislative session or when there was a general election coming up and members have less availability of time.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Just looking at a raw number, good point, by the way, Mr. Martin. A raw number, whatever, 3 years sounds good, even five would be okay. But on that topic, whatever number gets us the most qualified and cheapest applicant would be the number I'd be willing to go with. Mm-hmm. With this caveat, and I'd like the RFP that you're going to present us with, proposal, we should have an escape clause that would allow us, upon certain conditions, to just fire them. And on the other side of that coin, they perhaps would want to have a escape clause upon them performing some conditions, whether it's a payment of penalty or whatever. But if we go 3 to 5, so be it, as long as there's an escape clause for us.
I think there's all in government contracts, there's always a provision to terminate at the convenience of the government. I mean, that's always built in for any government contract. So
our prior contracts members did have an escape clause. It was, I think, with 30 days notice prior to, I think, the start of the fiscal year. So essentially, by May 1st, there had to be a choice made of whether either side wanted to discontinue. And so something similar to that, I would, at a minimum, anticipate in putting into any document.
You know, although my thoughts were more 3 years, but, you know, maybe we could just put the RFP. We can negotiate 3 to 5 years, you know, just see who's out there and who wants to, what they propose. 3 to 5 years, okay. Hopefully we don't go to 4, though, right?
Well, yeah.
That messes everything up. So.
Mr. Chair, I agree. The idea of having an odd, so that it's in the off session, so
sure.
We don't run up against the task of not having the commission set up and all that fun.
So time limit, okay. And thank you, Representative Nelson, for bringing that to our attention. Anything else that we need to look at? Mr. Martin?
Members, I think that that essentially covers the, that gets me at a point where I can now produce something for you to to look at next time, and I'll try and work up a draft RFP and circulate it, and we'll also post it for other interested parties to comment on.
Okay. Before we adjourn, we've got some members of the public here. Does anybody here who wants to weigh in on any of this factors we ought to consider for this consulting actuary? I don't see anybody coming forward. Okay. They just want to hear what, well, they're bored. They haven't got anything else to do because there's nothing going on right now. That's why they're here. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Well, best of luck to both of you, Representative Smith and Representative Elson, and hope to see you next session. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.
Good luck, Chairman. Next few weeks. Can I quote you on my material?
Not in the campaign.